The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Awakening of Faith teaching. All bodhisattvas aspire to the enlightenment realized by the Buddhas, disciplining themselves to this end and advancing towards it. Briefly, three types of aspiration for enlightenment can be distinguished. The first is the aspiration for enlightenment through the perfection of faith. The second is the aspiration for enlightenment through the understanding and through deeds. The third is the aspiration for enlightenment through insight. Before I get into this, I just wanted to mention, because some of you have been asking about Hogan, because he's on the health and healing list. So he had knee surgery last week, right? Both knees replaced, so he's slowly becoming a robot. And so it's kind of a big deal because it's both knees. So, but he's fine. And we just wanted to give him a little mojo for his operation. So we've been chanting his name. He's at home. He's doing physical therapy in pain, but getting better. So not to worry. The Awakening of Faith is a teaching from the 6th century. It's attributed to Ashvaghosha, but it's thought that it was written later than he lived in China. And it's in the West, it's not as well known as other Mahayana teachings, some Mahayana teachings, sutras. But in the development of Mahayana Buddhism, it was extremely important in China, in Korea, in Japan, in the Zen tradition. It was very influential. And one of its essential teachings is the Tathagatagarbha, the womb of the Buddha, or embryo of the Buddha. And so scholars talk about how it was, in a sense, addressing this eternal question in Buddhism, which is, if we all possess Buddha nature, if we all have the enlightened mind within us, then why are we deluded? And why does the delusion run so deep? Why is it so challenging, so difficult to free ourselves of our delusion if we already possess Buddha nature? I mean, if we were, you know, just sort of messed up from the beginning and that was our nature, I mean, if we were inherently deluded, then one, there wouldn't be a whole lot we could do about it because that would be our basic nature. And two, it would take a whole lot longer, like forever. But this question of why, if our nature is fundamentally pure and unhindered, are we so hindered in life? And so it also touches on the teaching of the Ilaya, this storehouse consciousness in which all of our karmic actions, the seeds of which reside within this deep, unconscious, subconscious aspect of our mind, in which there's been such profound study within the Yogacara school of Buddhism, and to help us understand why these deep inclinations, these deep habit patterns are so deep and so at times seemingly intractable, seemingly. And so this is just a section from the Awakening of Faith, and I wanted to begin on this first aspiration of faith today and then pick up the other two on Sunday. And so he talks about in the beginning, there's the aspiration for enlightenment through the perfection of faith, and then through understanding and through actions, and finally through insight. In the beginning of this chapter, the author talks about the subject of regression comes up a lot. Of being on a path, how is it that we can be moving forward, we can be committed, have aspired, be steadily moving forward, and then seem to regress, to move backwards? How can we be so confidently on the path and feel so sure in that, and then at some later part, at some later point, really lose our way altogether and no longer be on the path? How is that so? And so there are a lot of teachings starting from the Buddha about different ways in which we enter into the path, because we're all individual people, right? We all have one nature, and we all are part of the human family. And so there's a lot we share in common, in fact, with so many creatures beyond human, in terms of genetics and so on. But as human beings, we share so many things in common, and yet we're different, right? We have different karma. We're born differently into this world. Based on how we appear in the world, we are related to differently. We grew up in different families and different cultures and so on. And so that there are, in this passage, he talks about people who have an excellent capacity for goodness and have been able to meet the Buddhas. In other words, encounter the teachings, encounter a teacher, and serve them and honor them and practice the faith in the Buddha treasure and the Dharma treasure. And that their aspiration for enlightenment would be developed through their study. And then there are those who have very strong karmic obstructions, who come into practice, and because we've all lived a life by the time we get here, we all come pretty well packed with ourselves, with our lives, our history. And some of us come in with, differently in terms of the experiences we've had, the advantages or disadvantages, the support or lack of support, the kindness or the lack of kindness that we've experienced in our lives, and then how we have responded to that, to those things, and the patterns that we've set up in doing that, in our just honest, endeavor to live and to make it in life and to thrive in the best way we can, given the resources we have to work with internally and externally. So we arrive differently. And so points to there, people with strong obstructions who will make progress in the path, but will sometimes experience regression, which is, in a sense, pretty much all of us. And then there are those who encounter favorable conditions in which to practice and find their way in that. That could be favorable internal conditions, or it could be that finding the Dharma, finding the three treasures is made easy. You know, it's very easy. You know, there are people living in Brooklyn who encountered the Dharma because they lived on the same block as the temple. You know, so all they had to do was just walk a few steps down the street, and there was a Sangha and teachings and a teacher. But all of these, in all of these conditions, or sort of all of these backgrounds, the text says that that all of these types of aspiration are, in essence, inconsistent, because when we meet with unfavorable circumstances, we will sort of fall back. And as we strive or struggle to meet with those difficult circumstances. And so the development of the aspiration of enlightenment, for enlightenment through the perfection of faith, developing our faith, right? And faith is such an interesting thing. There are so many qualities that we seem to share with other creatures, emotions like anger or fear. I think it was Tom Brown, I remember reading a book of his where he talked about in his development of his skills in survival, he talked about in his tracking skills about sort of developing, I think it was developing his skills to get as close as he could to a grizzly bear. And so he wanted to see if he could get so close that he could pat it on the rump. And so he did, and the bear was not pleased with this. So, and this is a grizzly bear, so it turned and was in full pursuit of Mr. Brown. And so he just made it to dive under his truck or his car to get out of the way of the bear. And he said the bear was so clearly pissed off that it proceeded to rip off the bumpers. It was just demolishing the car. He said, this bear was angry. So emotions like anger or grief, joy, we see creatures that seem clearly to be experiencing happiness, to be playing, to be contented. But faith is sort of seems to be something that we possess, or maybe we just don't recognize it in other creatures, or maybe they have their own sort of collection of non-tangible qualities. But faith is such a sort of remarkable virtue, phenomena that we experience, that we have faith in things. Faith is, we could talk about it in different ways, but it's basically having some kind of confidence or belief or trust in something that we don't know yet, we haven't confirmed, or that isn't measurable, that somehow it always involves a kind of a leap from where we are in our tactile sensation bodies and what we can do and what we can measure and sort of, describe. And it's a leap into some other realm in our mind that puts us into a very particular relationship with that which we have faith in, whatever that be. And that allows us to do all kinds of things that just wouldn't be possible. We would be different creatures. We would live in a different kind of way without faith. We don't know what that is, right? Because we're not that creature. Although maybe when we lack in faith in a serious way, we get glimpses of what that's like in terms of how that holds us back, hinders us, sort of makes things very, very difficult. In a sense, makes things difficult that are not within the realm of what is, tangible and measurable and, controllable. That leap into faith, that leap with faith, is sort of leaping into an understanding that we are bringing something forth that is very much within us, and we're very much a part of it, but we're not in control of it. And that's the faith. And so it's interesting that faith takes such sort of visible form within religious practice, particularly when that religious practice is grounded in that which cannot be measured. Then the faith is essential, right? If we came into the Dharma and said, okay, I'm only going to do what I can measure, right, and what I can quantify. I was speaking to somebody recently in the New Zealand session last week, who's in a degree program, graduate degree program in psychology. And I don't know, it may be clinical psychology, so there's a lot of sort of scientific analysis and scientific method. And a very sincere student of the Dharma, but was saying because of his study in this field and being very immersed in it, that he was really having doubts about practicing with sanghas because he didn't say it, but what I was hearing was because basically they're functioning without all of these sort of scientific methods. And I said, well, what would that look like? And he said, well, you know, that you would have various forms, ways of assessing and measuring and, you know, comparing and quantifying one's development and the development of bodhicitta and so on and so forth. And I said, that just ain't going to happen. That's not what this is. But that doesn't mean that there isn't, that it's not evidence-based, that it's not, there isn't sort of stepping forth into a kind of experiment, a kind of venture, if you will, in which we don't actually know the outcome, although others have spoken of it. And our stepping forward is to verify that again. In other words, do that experiment again and prove that it's true. And so that raises all the question, well, what is it to regress? What is it to go backwards? Can you even do that if you try? What does that mean? Does it mean going back in time? Does it mean going back to some previous version of yourself? Well, that's just not possible. So what does regression mean? Clearly, it's understood that we have the experience of a sense of moving forward. We have the experience of a sense of being stuck, static, not moving. And then we all have the sense of what it feels like or how we experience regression, moving backwards. Somehow we seem to be going back into earlier states, ways of being, ways of responding. And yet all along, because of the nature of karma, we can only move forward. There's no other option. I mean, in that sense of moving forward, moving forward is an idea of something, right? The fact that tomorrow follows today doesn't mean that tomorrow is moving forward from today. That's just something we do in our mind. And so what is even the notion of regression, advancement, being stuck? Because those are experiences that we shouldn't ignore, and yet when we experience them and sort of reflect or assess or respond to them, do we know how to do that in a way that's trustworthy? In other words, is our reflection always accurate? What are we basing it on? What standard? What are we using to compare? So these are the kinds of things that every practitioner has to work out. Basically, will experience, and experiencing them is met with, what do you do? How do you meet that? How do you understand it? And so he said, the author said, in developing the aspiration for enlightenment through the perfection of faith, what kind of mind should we be cultivating? What is the mind of faith? It says, briefly speaking, there are three kinds that we can discuss. The first is the mind characterized by straightforwardness, for it correctly meditates on the principle of suchness. The second is the mind of profoundness, for there is no limit to its joyful accumulation of all kinds of goodness. And the third is the mind filled with great compassion, for it wishes to uproot the sufferings of all sentient beings. This mind of straightforwardness, for it correctly meditates on the principle of suchness. And we might understand that as being clearly, securely grounded in the Dharma, that we are actually practicing the Dharma, Buddha Dharma, that we're not just, this isn't just a meditation hall. It's a hall of awakening for bodhisattvas on the bodhisattva path. It is a hall in which we practice Buddha Dharma. Because it is that particular path that we're on. If we were in a different sacred space in which there was a different path, we would be practicing, in a sense, a different Dharma, and practicing according to that. And so this mind of straightforwardness is being clearly grounded in the Dharma, that that's what we are actually practicing, and correctly meditating on the principle of suchness, which means before we even understand or have any understanding of suchness, that we're practicing in a way that is in harmony with suchness, which is your nature. The mind of straightforwardness is a straight-ahead mind. In a sense, it's simple in the sense that it's uncluttered and it's uncomplicated by delusion, uncomplicated by samsara. It's plain, like water. When I was reflecting on this, a memory that came to mind was many years ago, many, many years ago. Actually, it was my first year here because I was the Tenzo. And every year we had a karate group come, which was sort of our major event of the year. This was when things were very small resident sangha. And our retreats were generally very small. And so this we would have, 60, 70 karate students come for Thursday to Sunday, which was a huge endeavor for us. Now we kind of do that all the time. But then it was a big deal to make all of that food and do all of the preparations. And so I was the cook, and so, I'd spent weeks preparing for this, and then we spent all week, making all of this food and getting it all ready. And, the refrigerators, which were not what we have now, were completely packed. And so we're really at our limit, and to really, host this retreat, that was also an important training for this karate group, and it was also an important event for us. And so we're sitting there; they're supposed to be here by noon, and the food's all on the table, and we're all ready to greet them and get this thing going, and off we go. And it's 12:15, and it's 12:30. And they're not there. And Dado said, well, maybe somebody should call and see if they ran into trouble on the road. So somebody who will not be named called, who was also the programming coordinator at the time, who had set the whole thing up, and came back very quietly to say that it's next week. And I remember going into a kind of shock. I don't know how else to describe it, where basically everything just stopped functioning. And I remember I just sat down on the couch, which used to be in front of the fireplace, and there were only a few of us, really. We all just sort of sat there and was just like, literally, it's like I didn't know what to do. I couldn't move. And I was frozen. And Sato Suzuki, who's now Sato Roshi, was living here at the time. And so I was just sitting there completely in a stupor. And he walked by and said, come, come. That was it. He said, come. And just like that, we were packing things up, putting them in fridges. We were just alive again. That simply, he just brought me back to life. And I thought of that because it was such a straightforward moment. Not overly caught in projections, intrigues, drama, you know, which is hard for us to give up sometimes because, you know, dramas are dramas. They're dramatic, right? We kind of like them. And we can think that because that, you know, the things we have been entertaining ourselves with and getting pleasure and excitement and meaning and sense of self and so on, the idea of giving that up, you know, in our mind, whether we're conscious of it or not, is just sort of like, it's like maybe we're just going to enter into some sort of dead zone. You know, where now life is just completely boring and flat. It's like, who wants that? But of course, it's not that. Not by a long shot. The second is the mind of profoundness, for there's no limit to its joyful accumulation of all kinds of goodness. I mean, the mind of straightforwardness is really every moment of practice. What's in front of you? What's in front of you? What's in front of you? When the mind gets complicated, right? When it enters in, when it starts building worlds, constructing universes too plain like water. Right? And in that, we encounter something extraordinary. Which all of these ancestors have spoken of. We encounter the mind of profoundness. We encounter the wondrous simplicity of this moment, which has no limit to its joyful accumulation of goodness. No limit to its nature, to the way it appears, to its expression, to its capacity. And we see that that same nature, which seems unlimited in its capacity to bind us, has the same unlimited ability to liberate us. Because it's one mind. It's one nature. It isn't stepping out of one shop and going shopping in another store. There's only one place. We are always drinking from the same water. And the power of our mind is such that we can taste this water as bitter and this water, the same water, as sweet. This mind of profoundness, it's like holding this tremendous, I don't know what the word is, force, world, universe, unimaginable, in our hands and not yet knowing we're holding it, and then beginning to have the sense that we are holding something, there's something that we are in possession of. We're not yet fully aware of it, we don't yet fully understand it, we don't really know how it works, but we're beginning to get glimpses of that. Beginning to get glimpses of its power in a moment where you are intractably stuck. There's no getting out of this one. Not this time. You're in this forever. And then one, two, or three breaths later, you can't find that anymore. You cannot find that bondage. And nothing changed except your mind. I was thinking about this in talking to some of you practicing at home who, and over these months, have mentioned often about how appreciative you are, how grateful you are to have a path. You know, and think about that. To think about at a time when the world is no longer the same, where the ground falls away, where something collapses. And just being sort of destitute in that, right? Struggling to find something to hold on to, some way to grasp this or not, to understand this or not, to meet it or not. And then there's having a path. You know what to do. And if you don't know what to do, somebody you know does. If you'll ask. You have a way in. I remember when my dad was passing, in the process of passing, moving towards that, I was anxious about his passing, not because he was going to die, but because I was afraid, because he did not have a path. I thought, how is he going to find his way in to this? This is a time that is needed. He is going to be called upon to meet this. And he hasn't cultivated, developed, from my perspective, a way to meet that. He ended up doing okay. But it did really raise for me that sense of being a practitioner, of having a path, which doesn't mean it's always easy. It doesn't mean we always know exactly how to find our way in. But we will find out if we turn towards it. No limit to the joyful accumulation of goodness which is in you yourself. Isn't that why, or it seems like that must be why, when we do not live in accord with that goodness, it hurts. It's really simple. It's really simple. When we don't live in accord with that goodness, it hurts, and we get the message somehow. We have an experience that is sending a message that we're in pain in some form or fashion. And so then the third mind for cultivating this perfection of faith is the mind of great compassion, which wishes to uproot the sufferings of every sentient being and yourself. Having such goodness within ourselves, having faith in it, because otherwise, why would you be here? Why would we be here? And more, as we see that, not just in faith, but we're verifying that goodness within ourselves. And we're seeing, being able to recognize it more and more in unexpected ways. It's not that what we're seeing is new, but our seeing it is new. We're seeing it in a different way. Something that we might have thought was a sign of our not to goodness. We're able to see the goodness in that. And so then, both naturally and as we cultivate that great mind of compassion through metta practices, we see that in others. That's the love of the bodhisattva, right? It's not based on personality or story or shared things in common, although those things can all be there. It's just your being. And it's the being of all things. It's seeing things abiding within their own virtue, whatever kind of creature they are. We see that being as fulfilling its virtue. even when it acts against it. This is how it's possible to love your enemies from a Buddhist perspective. And so we can see how these three minds feed into each other. The straightforward mind is the mind of everyday life, of every moment. It's practice mind. It's let go and return mind. It's keep your eyes open mind. It's ground under your feet. It's see the person, not your projection mind. Which then brings us, allows us to encounter this profound mind, this absolute mind that is limitless. Because what the straightforward mind allows us to do is to unclutter ourselves, body, mind, emotion, physicality, energy, however we inventory this miracle of being. It allows us to let go of our grasping. And our grasping, by its nature, not only does limit, but isn't it really intended to limit? It's intended to make things smaller because then they seem more negotiable, more controllable, safer somehow. And so, in a sense, we fear that spaciousness. We fear emptiness. Just the idea of it. I think most of us, when we first encounter this language in Buddhism, you know, we're not imagining some incredibly warm, you know, lovely thing. It's like dark, black, you know, it's like, you know, scary. Right? And then that must lead us to the mind of compassion. And these are not sequential as they sound. They're really all happening together. They really need to all be happening together. That's what training is about, is that we pick up the whole thing. It's sort of like you sit down to a banquet and you take a bite of everything at once. And the questioner asks in the text, if the Buddha said that all things are unified and that the essence of every Buddha is non-duality, non-dualistic, you, me, everything, everyone, everything, why is it then that people don't just meditate directly on suchness? Why do we do all these other practices? Why do we cultivate compassion? Why do we practice mindfulness? Why do we serve? Why do we practice the precepts? Why do we practice atonement? Why do we do work practice? Why do we do all these various? Why don't we just concentrate directly on suchness? If that's our nature, which it is, then why don't we just go directly to that which is our nature? And the actual fact is that's exactly what we do. That is exactly what we do. And because we cannot see suchness, it has to appear because that is profound, the profound mind. We practice it by bringing forth our straightforward mind. We practice it in as it appears in things, as it appears in actions, it appears in practices. Also, what the author says is because even though we are nothing but suchness, our karma, our mind, our karmic mind, our views, our attachments, and so on, all the entanglements, actually prevent us from seeing clearly, make it very difficult to practice straightforward mind. You know, that simple koan that students practice in the beginning of koan study, how do you go straight ahead on a path with 99 curves? Is really an excellent koan. In a sense, it's very straightforward and simple, but it's also very profound. And it really, that's what, whether we're conscious of it or not, when we're trying to practice well, that's what we're endeavoring to do, is to go straight ahead and pass through on a path that seems endlessly curvy and endlessly obstructed. And so we practice expediently. We practice skillfully, which means we learn how to be skillful. We learn how to be skillful in our zazen, in meeting this mind, to be skillful in this body, within the weight, the gravity, the heat, the coolness, the energy, the tension, the relaxation, the fluctuations, the miracle. We learn how to be skillful within this body, to be skillful in this mind, facing such ordinary phenomena as thoughts and emotions and memories and fantasies and all this ordinary stuff, which is the doorway which we need to become very familiar with, which we can't do when we're lost in it. We're not becoming familiar when we're lost in it because we're not aware. And so practicing expediently, and so resolving to really engage this session deeply, vigorously, to challenge ourselves. And then as you meet those challenges, now it's not abstract anymore. Okay, and when we make that aspiration, everything's good, we're feeling good, it's like the field is clear in front of us, and with great courage we make this aspiration, but nothing's happening yet. And then things start happening. And that's why we make that aspiration at some moments from a very clear place, so that establishing ourselves there, then when things become not clear, not open, we come back to that aspiration, which is faith. Our faith in our capacity to do that, in what we're aspiring for, towards. And we practice in that faith, which is what can you call it? It makes all things possible. And to the degree that that is, that we are cultivating that, we will, in a sense, experience that incipient or that developing faith. Because it's there enough for us to be here. But we feel it hasn't quite gotten all of its arms and legs yet. Because we simultaneously will have doubts and anxiety and feel insecure and lacking of confidence, and that's okay. Right? The fact that we can have those very sort of visceral experiences and continue, have the faith to continue, is why I say that faith makes all things possible. It says, that bodhisattvas will continue to experience things on the path that are challenging, that are very challenging. You know, practice doesn't domesticate the world. It doesn't make everybody fall in line. It doesn't make everyone's heart fill with compassion and love for each other. It doesn't do that. It helps us to see that that Tathagatagarbha, that womb of the Buddha, is in everyone, so that each person has that within them. It may just not be very active. But as we continue to be challenged in our lives, that more and more we leave fear behind. And even if it means falling into regression, even if it means not feeling up to it, feeling insecure, it's not the same. That sense of maybe I can't do this, maybe I shouldn't, maybe I won't, disappears. Because we realize you can't actually go back. We can sit or not. We can study the teachings or not. But we can't go back. And moreover, we see that those challenges more and more are welcomed. And sometimes we have to work into that welcoming. It doesn't always happen in the first moment when something arrives. But because we've experienced over and over and over again that in those challenges and some of those greatest challenges were the greatest openings, the greatest mind that was brought forth, that we see that as an opportunity arriving again. And so, as with every session, we are moving towards the latter part. And so, you know, what's important is to both know that it's Friday, so you don't waste time, and to forget that it's Friday, so you don't waste time. That Friday is just a word on a continuous path, on a life path. The beginning, middle, and end of Sesshin is not lacking in meaning, but it doesn't mean the same thing. And so to practice all the way through, and to really be aware, reflect on this sort of miracle of faith. What is this faith? And what is the difference between faith that is alive and skillful and blind faith? What is the faith, what you might call faith, that is not going to serve you well? How can you recognize that? In other words, what do we each need to know about faith and understand about it to use it well? That's something we should all get clear about.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.